My name is Alec Janvier, Alec J. I'm from Cold Lake, Alberta. I'm a Dene Songkhina. That's what I am, tribally. I see some of you guys, I'm not sure if you're just turning red face because of anger or something, you know. But sometimes we flash our wonderful color, you know, in public place like this. Because when we drink, we always love to put on an act, right? Actors, you know. It's too bad we never made a Hollywood. But some of us might have. I'm very honored to be here today. I'm an alcoholic. I drank as much as I could. And every time I drank quite a bit more than I should, I became an instant white man. I started bragging, started big plans, and I started looking at white women. And I don't know if that qualifies me as an alcoholic, but that's what had happened. I'm here because I took that first drink. And I was at college, in the art college, and it was Christmas time. And artists, they drink like fish, you know. And we're a little bit on the crazy side of society. So we just love to show our fangs every once in a while, you know. And this one time, about the second year, you know, a nice lady, a nice woman, sat beside me and started talking. I had a heck of a time to even respond, you know. I liked her, but I didn't know how to proceed, you know, to anything that would be connecting as a conversation. Anyway, after I had a few drinks of this Canadian club, they call it. It's a fire water, they call it in Indian language. That thing just burned me right down, you know, throat and down. And I thought I was going to die. Well, the second round, boy, I started to live. And my God, that girl looked beautiful, you know. I was beginning to see Cinderella. Yeah. And so that was the beginning of what it was to become. The beginning of 9.5 years of complete self-destruction. I took it easy at the beginning. You know, I try to be a moderate drinker. God, you guys are serious. Anyway, can you imagine an Indian doing a moderate drinking? Well, this one, you know, he failed right from first drink on. I could go on and tell you all these, everything in detail. But after 15 years in this society, I did go to Miami and I did see Bill W. from way up on stage. And I was way, way back with the rafters there with a pig farmer from Georgia. He looked at me and he says to me, "You Indian?" And I looked at him and I said, "You pig farmer?" We followed each other just like glue for the rest of the 3 days. Wonderful relationship. You know, Ku Klux Klan pig farmer than an Indian from the Cold Lake. Yeah. And It was a wonderful exchange of friendship. I had a few troubles being in your country. You know, we stopped in one of these restaurants, and, you know, they have this funny dish, and they put butter on it, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to eat it. And my wife didn't help much. She didn't. She's the first time she saw that, too. You know, those grits? Yeah. For a northerner, that's some of the new dish I'd never seen up there. So, had a little trouble on the road. I do respect this program. It helped a lot of our people. And the first example in my tribe was my cousin, a man called Cyril. This man all of a sudden disappeared from the table of genius Indians drinking. He disappeared. And we condemned him, you know. We knew he had a, you know, he's a weakling anyway, you know. He showed it finally, you know. Anyway, that's the first example on my reservation. And my dad heard about this. He says, my son, he says, has quit drinking. And he's turned into a saint, he says. And I couldn't figure out the old devil turning into a saint, you know. But that's the first example on my reservation. Others have tried and they failed. They went to jail, they caught a little bit of dryness or sobriety or something. They come home and we'd know they'd drink anyway. So that was the example there. But Cyril, to the day he died, he never took that drink again. And that's the example that came to my reservation. And a few of us now are in this program. I have two boys that's in the program. And both of them, I couldn't help. But this is what I had to do. I had to turn them over to the higher power. And both made it. They're still sober today because of the higher power. I'm very honored just to speak to you people today. A little bit about me. I didn't drink very well. In 9.5 years, I was self-destroyed. And I love whiskey. And I kind of liked a white woman, too, you know. After a few drinks, they looked just like Cinderella. And that was the method that started to happen in my life. But like I said, in 9.5 years, I was completely destroyed. My will was gone. And any kind of honesty was gone. And I just didn't have any connection anymore with a higher power of any sort. I once trained to become a Catholic priest. That's why I got an education. They fooled me, you know, these old priests. They wanted me to become one of them. But when I went into that seminary after 4 months, you know, they interrogate you just like a CIA interrogates you guys. And they asked me, what do you want to be, you know? Well, I said, I'll be an artist, and then I'll be a priest. And he stared at me for about 2 minutes. And these are the words he used on me. He said, you can't serve two masters. That's what I was told. My response to that, well, get me the hell out of here then. So they put me on a train the next day back to Alberta. And I went to an art school to follow that. And I'm a successful person as an artist today. But I had a lot of help from my wife. She's sitting in a crowd here. Without that woman, I would never amount to anything. Not only that, she bore four handsome boys. The shortest guy, just for your girl's information, shortest guy is 6 foot. The next guy is 6'1", 6'2", and 6'3". And they're all, some of you see those kids, they're pretty handsome. And then there's two daughters in between. They're lovely daughters, too. So, you know, this alcoholism, you know, leads people into success if there's a higher power in your life. You know, that's the strangest power that any alcoholic can have or receive. To come to know of a power known as God. I didn't get to that right away, you know. It took me 15 years. And I had this old skinny cowboy, you know. I thought I could talk circles around that bastard, you know. He had my number the day I walked in to his trailer. And he let me suffer, you know. But he knew I also went through the irony of education in the Indian residential schools. I've been in it for 11 years. And so my life did change. And I cared for nothing no more. No one. No person. Not even my parents. That's the kind of person I became as a young man. You throw alcohol in there and you get into real deep trouble. And that's where I found myself. How this program came to me was that I went to this a meeting at the Canadian Air Force Base. And it's a place where no self-respecting Indian want to go. Because he's military. They got badges and, you know, they really think they're on top of the world. I guess they are. And they're well decorated, you know. But they brought in Alcoholics Anonymous into the territory. And my old father, you know, he always, being the old chief, he always listens for good things in our society. And he actually 12-stepped me without knowing. That's what he did. I went to the first meeting. I walked a long ways. And about halfway, some of my drunken friends stopped, you know. I thought they were going to give me a lift. They asked me, are you tired of walking? I said, yes. And they sped away and they hollered at me, keep walking. So I kept walking. I did get to the military base gate. I was stopped abruptly. And they wanted to know what business I had to do with the military. I said, there's a meeting here of Alcoholics Anonymous on your, in your area. I'd like to get to it. Do you have credentials? I didn't have a single thing. I told him I'm Treaty Indian number 287. That didn't even stand, you know. Yeah, nothing. Anyway, it turned out I went to my first meeting. And I heard some incredible things from a bunch of ex-bootleggers and liars. You know? And this is what they said. If you don't take that first drink, you won't get drunk. Now, isn't that the most insulting thing an alcoholic can hear? God, how could they do this to me? My first meeting. And you know, after they gave me a ride up to the mission, the Catholic mission, and from there I had to walk about another 4 miles. And you know, that darn thing started to work on me. You know, if you don't take that first drink, you won't get drunk. And it was driving me crazy, you know. And I finally crawled into bed and I thought I would fall asleep. And that thing just kept, you know, going around. You know, once you get the message, it stays with you, you know. And that one stuck with me. And that changed my life. I go to meetings today, right around the whole area, and this is a top secret. You know, you put money in there, ain't right? When a bag comes around, I used to put two large washers, and they would quietly give it back to me. So next week, I would quietly put the two washers in. That's how I joined your people. Everybody thought I was paying right into it. Yeah. I don't know how much time I got here left. 2 minutes? God, that's short time, eh? Anyway, within 2 minutes, I'll let you know that I did sober up, and my sponsor put me in the chapter of the agnostic. There's a chapter in there for a guy like me who was supposed to have gone to become a priest, and because he made deals, you know. I made deals with God, and he didn't deliver. He never delivered me a bottle of whiskey or bringing somebody that had a lot of money to go and drink together. I didn't have all those lucks, you know. But the fortunate thing is that all this ill luck is what brought me to you people. You know. And I'm glad that it did happen that way. I've been happy to let you know that I'm going to give you a clue how to get an alcoholic proposes to a woman. Yeah. This is how it was. Either you go with me or you don't. She showed up 1 week later. We've been together since. That's an alcoholic proposal. I'm very fortunate just to be asked to speak to you people. I was going to tell you a bunch of lies, but I know you're a bunch of liars. You can catch on right away. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to fault myself into that one. Happy, joyous, and free. I'm a free man now from that terrible, terrible obsession to drink. Isn't that a terrible thing just to get that feeling, you know, to get that first drink? I don't know what it is about alcoholics. You got to really act it out, you know. And I remember I just glug, 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 glug as quickly as possible. And then you, you know, and you burn all the way down, you know. Isn't that a sensation, you know, we're familiar with, you know. And we, and it happens over and over and over. Today, you don't have to suffer those things. It's wonderful to be able to stop in time. I felt the hand of God touch my arm, so I better stop right here. Thank you.
Boy, you gotta watch out for these alcoholics, huh? I remember I was at my home group and there was this, they asked this old guy to share and he said, no, I pass. And then he went on for 20 minutes. And I'm like that too. I do that same thing. Let's just share a little bit about myself. I was born on the Navajo Reservation in Tuba City, Arizona, and was raised in, the Salt Lake City, Utah area. And, my alcoholic story has to do with a lot of jail time and a treatment program. The judge sentenced me to jail for my, a year for my seventh or eighth DUI. And then he also sentenced me to treatment right afterwards. And this guy was supposed to transport me from the jail to treatment. And I said to him, hey, I haven't seen my mom in a long time. What if I meet you there tomorrow? And he said, he knew exactly what I was thinking. You know, and he said, no, I'm taking you right to the treatment program. And, at the time, I was not grateful for any of that. But looking back on it, I have so much gratitude. You know, the kind of alcoholic I was, so stupid, so stubborn, so selfish. Oh, you couldn't tell me anything. And I could see that my higher power saw that it had to happen just like this. You need to be in jail for this long, and then you need to have to go to this other place. And I'm so, so very grateful for that. I got to a point with my drinking that it was, that I look, and I really like what Alex said about being free from that. Some mornings I wake up, and the first thing, I have this wave of gratitude that almost overwhelms me, and, you know, almost start getting emotional, that I'm not thinking about, the first time I get up, I'm not thinking about where and how can I get that next drink, and just consumed with that obsession, and you have to do whatever it is you have to do. And that's not the way for me anymore. And I just get so, so glad that I'm free from that obsession. It got so bad for me that I became alcoholic. I've got, you know, suicidal and scars on my wrist. My girlfriend OD'd on Christmas Eve. This is probably one of the lowest points of my life. And I remember when they were working on her in the ER, I remember, guess what I was doing out in the parking lot? Yeah. And this is over 30 years ago, and I still have a hard time saying that. It's still really hard for me to just, that's how far alcohol had gotten me to that point. And, you know, one of the things that I did after I got sober is I made a commitment that I would never let alcohol get in between me and my loved ones ever again. And because of this program, you know, it helped me to do that. It helped me to maintain that commitment. One of the things that really helped me when I first started out in AA was they said, you got to do a lot of service work. And so I went to meetings in the jails and in the prisons and treatment programs and, detoxes. And I have to tell you, maybe there are some of you who wake up in the morning and you say, you know, I think I'm going to make some cookies for my neighbor, or I think I'm going to help my, I'm going to help my neighbor with their yard. I have never woke up and had that thought. And that was one of the things that was good about AA for me, is it put me on the firing line, as it says in the big book, put me on the firing line where by myself, I wouldn't have done that. But because they said, you need to do this, Rod, and I had good sponsors and good old timers around me, and I saw it was working for them. And so I did what they told me, even though sometimes I didn't want to. But I could see the wisdom in all of those things that they were telling me. When I got to go home after chairing a jail meeting, an AA jail meeting, and that door slammed shut, you know, I had some gratitude that I didn't have when I left, when I first got in there. And let me tell you, some of you might relate to this. That jail air breathes differently than that free air, doesn't it? Yeah. Go ahead and introduce our next speaker, Dan Kay from Montana.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Kay, and I am an alcoholic from Montana. In addition to being an alcoholic, the Creator sought to make me a Kootenai Indian. Oh, in addition to being an alcoholic, the Creator saw fit to make me a Kootenai Indian. And so I've been asked to speak here today about my experience, strength, and I'm trying not to look. My mom was a tribal juvenile probation officer. And my dad was a tribal juvenile probationer. That'll kind of give you a quick assessment of reservation life in the 1970s. My dad didn't do anything but drink. And so my mom thought it was best to adopt me out through the system. And I was adopted to a Norwegian Anglo ranching family from eastern Montana. So I was incredibly unique. And I remain incredibly unique to this day. So I grew up knowing I was Native American. I knew my parents didn't keep that from me. But I didn't have the sense of being and the sense of place to appreciate what the Creator had done for me. I just didn't have that. So I spent most of my life trying not to be me. You know, I would... my mom will tell you, she would go to the store, and Indians couldn't go in to buy things. And so she would make herself look like she wasn't Indian so she could go in the store and buy things. And that will tell you, that kind of is what I tried to do for most of my life. I tried not to be me. I tried not to respect the Creator's choice in making me who I was. And I actively sought to diminish myself on a minute-by-minute basis. I was fortunate. My family is kind, and they made sure that I had education and food and everything I needed, and I didn't always appreciate that the way I should have. So around 16, my cousin Eddie and I decided that we were going to steal my grandma's liquor bottles from the airplane and sneak out into the golf course, which we were not allowed, and we were going to drink them. And I remember looking up at the stars as we're drinking these, and they were in glass back then. That'll tell you how old I am. And I remember looking up at the stars, and just as the warmth went right down the center of my body, and I was like, this is exactly how I want to feel the rest of my life. Nobody is going to make me feel, nobody's going to make me care, and I'm not going to have to feel the hurt and the pain and whatever it is that I'm holding on to ever again. And, it was just a night, but it seemed to last 20 years. In fact, it did. And I was never really able to catch that feeling again. I couldn't manage the drinks, or in my case, those other stuff. I never could manage it to catch that feeling again. And by the end of my drinking, I, on a day-to-day basis, I could not tell you how far down I was going to go. I would leave, I would wake up with a set of rules, and by the end of the day, those rules may or may not be there. I was successful. I had a house and all the things that people say, make the difference, but I just was dead inside and didn't care to be here, and I couldn't figure out a way to get out. I just didn't know the way. And, so I laid in my backyard, even though I had a job. That's not a wise idea. For 6 months, and I got drunk every day, and I drank it by the handled bottle, and I just waited to die. And, people put me in the back of my own car, and they said, we're going on a trip. And 400 miles later, I was at rehab. And it was kind of at the end of my drinking, I had said I kind of checked out and laid in my backyard. I had convinced myself that I was empowering my assistant to develop their skills by having my assistant do my job, because I could no longer type because of my drinking. I couldn't make my hands work at the same time. I decided that the best, since I thought the people at the liquor store were on to the fact I couldn't sign my name anymore, I would go to the cash machine. But I would stick my card in, and I couldn't make my fingers work fast enough before the machine would time out and spit my card back. So physically, I just couldn't manage anymore. I went to the hospital every day in a month in an ambulance, and one day I went twice. And how you do that is you fall down the flight of stairs, the EMT comes, they make you give up the two bottles of alcohol that you're holding, and they take you to the hospital, they sew you up, and when you wake up, you say to yourself, I need a drink. So you unplug yourself, and you walk home, and you start drinking again. And it turns out with a head injury, they like to send people back for you, and they'll bring you back. So that's the kind of situation I was in. I went to rehab 7 times in a calendar year. I have this dream here that I'm going to run into my first 12-step person who 12-stepped me first, and that's the insurance representative from Aetna Health Insurance. Who, a fine gentleman who I will never know his name. He called me on the phone and he said, you don't know me, but I work for Aetna, and you are burning up the ambulance. And have you ever thought about AA and getting a sponsor? when you've gotten on that level on Aetna's radar, you're causing some mayhem. So that's just how that goes. So I went to the rehab over and over. I picked out my little salmon and my laughing cow cheese and went to the museums as I was supposed to do. And every single time it didn't work. I would get drunk within a couple days. I just couldn't be. My insides never were equal to my outsides, and I was never in the right spot. And so the last time I got drunk, I went to back to one of the rehabs, and the lady says, well, we know you have Aetna, so you can stay. And I looked her right in the face, and I said, this is not going to do it. This will not do it. It has to be an inside thing. There's something broken. All the museums and all the food and all the bus trips are not going to fix it. So I checked myself out and I went back to where I lived, and I was sitting on a park bench and I was absolutely despondent because I did not know what to do. And I looked down and there was a rock sitting there, and it had a thumb hole where water or nature had worn it away. And I looked at it and I was like, you know what? You are taking pretty good care of yourself today, and you've been doing that for millions of years, and you've been doing it better than I have been. So I picked up that rock, and I went to my first AA meeting. I put it in my pocket, and I carried that rock around with me for years in my pocket. And when I had a problem that I didn't understand, I would talk to the rock. I mean, it seems crazy, but I didn't drink. And that became my higher power. I always had a problem with the beard and the bricks and that stuff, because it didn't match the trees and the rocks and the air and the people and the nature and what I know what I believe inside. It didn't match. My lives didn't match. And so that rock became my universe. I slowly got a couple days of sobriety thanks to the fine program of AA. And AA has really changed my life. I am learning to appreciate the Creator's gift to me and why it is so important and why, and how I can use it to help others, such as standing here. My sponsor's always telling me, just tell your story. So I'm just gonna do it. I get a little nervous. AA has really done a number on my life. I'm older, I have less hair, and other than that, still all the same defects as I had when I got here. Hopefully not, but, and through the process of AA, my insides have become equal to my outsides most of the time. You know, I'm not perfect. This morning, if the lady from the door is in here today, I need to make an amends to her, but I'm not perfect. But I get better as a result of this program and hanging out with you guys. I've been to Connecticut and Washington, D.C. and California, and I can breathe. I don't breathe as well as I do on the reservation, but I can still breathe. I can be me, and I can allow everybody else to be you. We're all good. I'm not nearly the unique, you know, person that I was. Every day I'm kind of resentful. Some days I wake up and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm just ordinary. You know what I mean? I'm like, what happened? I've been blessed by the program of AA, and I don't share it enough. So, AA has allowed me to rejoin my my family, even though I was still physically with them. I wasn't mentally there, or my heart wasn't there. And it's allowed me to do a lot of beneficial things. I've, as a result of this program, I've been able to become a judge and do a whole bunch of things like work in Washington, D.C. and make justice for Indian people, help do that. And that is something I could not do without you guys. I could not do anything that I do today without AA. Because if left to my own devices, I'm that kid who's so drunk I can't plug in four numbers. And I'm the kid who doesn't want to be here, and you're not going to make me feel or experience or participate. And so I really have to say thank you for welcoming me to the rooms and making me feel like I belonged, even when I was just looking at you and picking out differences. You know, my first meeting was the men's prison meeting in Butte, Montana. And I sat there, and all I got from the meeting, I mean, I couldn't hold my coffee. I was wearing slippers, and I was like 3 days sober with the little rock. And I remember they said, you will be amazed before you are halfway through. And I looked up, and I was like, yeah, wow me. You know what I mean? I'm waiting. Wow me. Go ahead. Make my day, right? I'm good. And I would really have to tell you that that's how it has been, only better. I call my new life my life of escalators, elevators, and moving sidewalks, because it is breathlessly easy compared to even the best day before. The best day before was sorrow, misery, mayhem, and despair. And the only reason I came was because I wanted a 50-50 chance. That's all I wanted. I wanted a 50-50 chance that things might be just okay for today. Because they never were okay when I drank. I can only say thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate your story about your powerlessness, because I can relate to that so much. I think everybody in this room can relate to that. I always wondered, what is there about AA that has us all together like this? Because when we were changing rooms, you know, I heard
somebody said to somebody else, it's good we're all sober. Because if we were coming in and out like that, if there was some drink, if there was some alcohol, it would have been scary. And sometimes I think to myself, how is it that we manage to do that? And in the second tradition of AA, it says our ultimate authority is a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. So that's one ultimate authority we have, a higher power. And I think our second ultimate authority is alcohol. And we all know that if we succumb to that higher power, it's going to kick our asses and we're going to be dead. And I think that's why we all give of ourselves somehow, some way, so that we can all keep this thing together. And for me, it's been a lot of service work that I've done. I'm from the Pacific region out west, and there are 15 areas in there. Usually an area is a state. So there was this guy, he said, I do service work in Alcoholics Anonymous to pay back the debt I owe AA. The only problem is, the longer I stay in this thing, the bigger the debt gets. And I can sure relate to that. I sure understand that. I wanted to say a little bit about some of the things that I've noticed with Alcoholics Anonymous and Native American tradition and culture. And I think I didn't understand this when I first came to AA. And I think sometimes a lot of Native people maybe don't understand that too, that there are a lot of similarities between step work and Native culture. I remember this one guy, I went to this sweat lodge. And for those of you who don't know, sweat lodge is the Native American ceremony, where they have these hot rocks in the middle in a pit, and the medicine man pours water on the rocks and steam comes off and it gets very hot, and that's when the singing and the prayers start. And it lasts about 3 to 4 hours depending on where you're at. And anyway, I was there to this one gentleman was pouring the water for the people. And he said, I have done some things that caused me great shame and great guilt. And he said, I went to my elders and I talked to them about these things. And I told them, I don't feel worthy to pour the water for the people. And he said, my elder said to me, it is exactly because of that unworthiness that you need to pour the water for the people. And I'm listening to that and I'm thinking, fourth step, fifth step, tenth step. You know, and I just kind of marvel at that sometimes. I went to this Native gathering in Arizona, and this one guy, he was talking about trying to get sober, and he tried everything he could think of, and nothing worked. And he went to this medicine man, and he told the medicine man about wanting to get sober, and the medicine man said, this is a white man's disease. It requires a white man's cure. And then he ran into AA, and he believes that that was what he was talking about. And another Native there, he said, there is a lot of similarities between Native culture and AA. He said, I think Bill W. went to a lot of powwows. So I've noticed that myself in the work that I've done. I've read the big book. I've read the 12 traditions and the 12 steps books and the concepts of world service and, you know, done a lot of those kinds of things. And I have a lot of knowledge about all of that. But one of the things I've learned is that, knowledge of the path is not a substitute for walking it. You know, and that's kind of some of the things that I've learned both in, Native teachings and in AA teachings. You know, and I'm really, really grateful for all of that. I had a chance in my journey to be the delegate for Utah in 97, 98. And one of the things that I said for a long time, and I know some people didn't appreciate it, but in the third chapter, in the third edition of the big book, there's a story, Join the Tribe. And I read that and I told people, and I know, like I said, some people, it wasn't very popular. I said, I'm not saying anything against the gentleman's story, but I've met very few natives who speak that kind of broken English anymore. You know, I said, maybe they need to update these, you know, add another update these stories, these native stories. And so I was elected to go to be a delegate and sent to the General Service Conference in New York, where they vote about these kinds of things. And I just happened to be put on the literature committee. And guess what one of our agenda items was? Yeah, a new edition of the Big Book in 1998. And so we talked in long hours into the night, you know, and the representatives, there's 93 delegates from the United States and Canada that go to New York every spring to do the, to discuss and vote on the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you, through your participation, you vote for all of those people, and then you can tell them what to do back there in New York. And, they're supposed to listen to you. But, one of the things that they talked about was about, there's a lot of things that we're asked to, consider when we're discussing these things. And this is one of the things that they told us to consider when we were discussing the new edition of the Big Book, the fourth edition. The story section, and this is from Bill W. He wrote a letter in 1954. The story section of the Big Book is far more important than most of us think. To increase the power and variety of this display to utmost should be, therefore, no routine or hurried job. The best will be none too good. The main purpose of the revision is to bring the story section up to date, to portray more adequately a cross-section of those who have found help. Since the audience for the book is likely to be newcomers, anything from the point of view of context or style that might offend or alienate those who are not familiar with the program should be carefully eliminated. You know, and we thought about these kinds of things. There was a lot of information that came to us. And after a long discussion, we presented the committee, the literature committee of delegates was about 10 or 12. And then we went to the whole General Service Conference members, who were about 130. And we presented to them the agenda item that there be a fourth edition of the Big Book. And they voted on it. And out of the 130, only about 5 people voted against it. And, you know, I was just very amazed. And yeah, the fourth edition, I've got my fourth edition Big Book here somewhere in my pack here. There are 2 updated native stories in the fourth edition Big Book. And so I'm just really, I like to share these kinds of stories because I think people need to understand how all of this is connected. You know, there are 3 legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous: recovery, unity, and service. And, we were told, what is the size of your triangle? You know, are they all equal sides? Are you doing as much service as you are recovery and the traditions, for instance? And I think that's a good way to understand it and look at it. I feel like it's something that we need to continue to talk about as we go forward. Because one of the things that I've learned is the most important person in any AA gathering is the newcomer. But one of the things I believe is there's even somebody more important than that, and that's the person who hasn't walked through that door yet. And it's our responsibility to make sure that this program is intact 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. You know, that we know that when I came here, thank God AA was here for me, because I don't think anything else would have worked. I really don't. And there may be, I'm sure there'll be people like that in our future. So I think that's our obligation and our responsibility. I'm not meaning to be on my soapbox, even though I accidentally got on top of it. But that's how strongly I feel about it. I want to introduce Dave D. from South Dakota, our next speaker.
I'm Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. And I listen to a lot of speaker tapes. And I heard a guy say this, that, and I thought I should, because they're recording it, I want them to know back in South Dakota where I come from that I'm in this, what is it, the World Congress building? Giant building. 50,000 alcoholics. All right here in this room, right? And that's amazing to me. I just thought, wow, and they invited me to be up here on this panel. I'm privileged to be here. I'm from South Dakota. I'm from, originally from Rapid City. I live in Custer now. It's about 50 miles away. It's a border town over there. My mom's from Pine Ridge. My dad came out to South Dakota to be in the Air Force. He's from Toledo, Ohio. So I'm a half-breed, and you know, when I was a kid, I didn't know what that was because all my relatives were Indians, and I hung out with them. We'd go to the reservation every weekend practically, and I didn't know there was a difference. And as I got older, I learned the differences, and then as I got older, I got a real chip on my shoulder about that and got really irritated and didn't like people in general. Just didn't like them. And I started drinking when I was pretty young. I grew up in this town, and it was where we lived, there was a lot of drunks down along the creek. And so I seen drunks my whole life. And when I was small, we would steal their bottles, float them down the creek. And then we would see if we could we'd put minnows in the bottles and creek water and see if we could get the drunks to drink it. And you know, I found that first, you know, I had drinks from the time I was little, just here and there, just, you know, controlled drinking with the parents giving it to you and the uncles. So I got sips, but that was about it. And the first time I got drunk, there was a gang that my brother belonged to, some gang that ran the streets, and they didn't want me in the gang. Back then I was kind of big and clumsy and overweight. Now I'm an Adonis. It took a while for that, but believe it or not, back then I was just big, you know, clumsy, overweight, slow, not very athletic. And they didn't want me in their gang, but I did learn how to be really sneaky. And they were down by the railroad tracks acting kind of strange. And then they left, and I went down there, and there was a case of beer, and I stole their beer. And I took it up the railroad tracks a couple blocks, and I was smart enough to know that just in case somebody's watching me, I'm not going to hide it all in the same spot. So I hid it in a few different spots, and then I went down to hang out with the gang just to see if they would, you know, let me hang out with them. And they didn't. And I thought, well, they had their chance. And I started to drink their beer, and it was just like you heard here today. It just was absolutely amazing. You know, I was on the banks there by the railroad track, and I was the life of the party. You know, I was the only one there, but I was the life of the party. You know, and you know, about three beers into it, I thought that gang, they were a bunch of losers. Why would I want to hang out with a gang like that anyway? You know, they're not going anywhere. You know, I knew I was going somewhere, and that's all I needed, you know. You know, the next day I tried to hang out with them again. Well, later on that night, I did run into them. And just in case they didn't know that I drank their beer, I spilled a little bit on me. And then I went up to the kind of the head guy in the gang, and I acted a little drunker than I was. And I pushed him a little bit and kind of ran into him. And, you know, I thought, this is just great. It was the best day of my life up to that point, because they wanted to kill me. And I knew they weren't going to do anything. I knew they weren't going to touch me, because I couldn't have drank all that beer. So they wanted it, and they did. And I did hide two beer cans in one corner, and I let them have two beers. And I told them I only found a six-pack. And anyway, they didn't believe any of that, but it felt so good to kind of push them around, and I just thought this was great. And so but from then on, I drank as much as I could. Drank as much as I could, as often as I could, and I was big, and so I could buy booze pretty young. I could buy booze. In fact, I used to hang out with a bunch of older guys, and they would make me buy the booze. They used to have drive-up liquor stores, and I would be in the back seat, and they would drive up, and I'd say, "This looks bad. You should let me drive," you know, because I'm in the back seat. "No, you just stay back there. We'll pull up." And so I did. I bought booze, and I got to hang out with the older guys, and, you know, I just drank a lot. I drank a lot and ended up going to treatment way before I was an alcoholic. And they prematurely sent me there. And I also, I was one of those drunks that did get beat up a lot. I got into car wrecks and motorcycle wrecks, and I rolled my pickup and in a blackout, and I passed out on a motorcycle one night. That was a bad deal. Bad night. So they took my vehicles away, and then I got ran over in the parking lot. And I wasn't safe on foot, apparently. And it was a bar parking lot, though, so and I knew the bouncer, and he came to my rescue and called the ambulance. I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, and I figured out I was going to live. And I called my buddy up, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to live, so can you bring some stuff up?" So he started bringing beer, and on Saturdays I would tell the nurses it was my religion that I'd fast on Saturday. And then Saturday he would bring up a six-pack of beer and a pizza and two half pints that he'd leave me with. And so I would drink with him and have pizza Saturday night, and then he'd leave me with the two half pints. And so I told my sponsor that story and after I sobered up, and he says to me, he said, you realize that's insane, don't you? And I said, yeah, I guess, you know. Sounds dangerous, I know. I just didn't see the insane part. And he explained it to me that the insanity is that I was doing the same thing in the hospital that got me into the hospital. And I thought, well, okay, if you put it that way, I kind of understand. I understand now what when you say that, you know, we're insane. And so my drinking, it was one of those, I just did things, I loved to drink, absolutely. And I was a whiskey drinker. You know, I had to drink it kind of slow because it went down too fast. It just, if you mix pop with anything, it goes down fast. So I would, and if it's straight, sometimes it's just smooth. So I'd add water to it to make it go down slower. And it kind of kept me, held me back. I thought it did. I thought it kind of, the rest of the crew didn't. I think it slowed me down, but I thought it was slowing me down. And I ended up getting married. I thought that would slow me down, and that didn't slow me down. I had a couple kids, and neither one of them slowed me down. And it wasn't until later on I was getting a divorce that kind of slowed me down. And that was a bad deal, and then but I was, you know, I was an electrician. I did construction work and traveled to different places on the road. And I would try to sober up a little bit, try to, you know, maintain, and just couldn't do it. Just couldn't. I mean, there was a lot of times I wanted to sober up and couldn't do it. You know, I listened to people talk about that, and I thought, well, I never did that. And, well, the truth was I knew I couldn't. I just knew that I couldn't stop drinking. The best I could do is say I was going to tell myself I'm going to slow down, I'm going to taper off, I'm just not going to drink so much. And But after about three beers, you forget, you know, you just forget. And, so I ended up drinking a lot, like I said, and I got into some car wrecks and went to jail. Whenever I didn't get into a wreck, they'd send me to jail. And apparently the way it worked then is that if you were in a wreck and you were in bad shape, they'd send you to the hospital. But if you're in a wreck and you were okay, they'd send you to jail. So I went to jail on the good wrecks and they weren't so bad. But I just got to be a nuisance, I guess. My family, pretty much didn't want to be around me. I kind of hid from them. I knew what I was doing wasn't right. I knew that the way I was living was not what I wanted to do. It's not the way I wanted to live. They were good people, you know, and I just couldn't stop drinking. And it just, you know, I'm kind of a light skinned and have blue eyes. And when I drink, you really notice that I'm Indian. I mean, it just comes out all over. It just comes out all over. Let me tell you. It's one of the things I can't hide. So I grew up in this town and I ended up, and I spent most of my life there and ended up sobering up there. I got, kicked out of my house one morning and the cops came to my house and they kicked me out. And I remember they were just disgusted, just absolutely disgusted with me. And the cops said, just leave and don't come back. And I thought, you know, I deserve to go to jail. You know, I thought he was going to work me over a little bit, send me to jail. And I was just humiliated. I thought, you know, the cops don't even want me anymore. This is not a good place. And I just walked away. You know, I just thought, oh God, I mean, I knew I shouldn't volunteer. So I just walked away. Then I thought, you know, further I got away, I thought, well, he's going to find out what's going on and probably going to chase me down. So I figured by then, no, I should just keep going, go hide. And I where I live, there's lots of places where drunks hide. And I knew about those hiding places for years. You know, they have little forts and where they drink and they stash their stuff. And I used to visit them occasionally and we would go down to the park. I was never actually a street person, but some of my best buddies were. And so I would visit them and drink with them. And I remember drinking with them and we would, they would have a gallon jug. It was a milk jug. And they would mix the stuff in there and they would mix, Lysol and they would mix it with lemon, with little screen bottles of lemon and then mix it with water and make this, drink. And they would pass the drink and I would drink it, you know, just to be sociable because that's what they had. You know, I knew that if they had whiskey, I would be drinking that too. And I would look at those guys and I think, God, if I ever got as bad as you guys, I would quit drinking. Man, that's just terrible. You bought this stuff? This is bad. And I just couldn't believe that, you know, they would get that bad off. And later on, I realized after I sobered up and I'm doing great in AA. Sober 3 years or something, went to the store. I had to go buy some rubbing alcohol, and I thought, well, geez, my first trip into the store with having to buy rubbing alcohol. I wonder how I'll do. And I'm sober three years in AA, and I went to the place, and I picked up the rubbing alcohol and thought, this is no problem. And then I was really brave, and I looked at the liquor store, and I thought, wow, it doesn't even faze me to look at the liquor store. And I walked by the cleaning products, and there was that Lysol, and I all of a sudden had a problem. I knew that I could pick that stuff up and buy it. Nobody would know what I was using it for. An AA person standing right next to me wouldn't have any idea. I just knew that. And I know, like, they taught me in AA, I have to be honest with myself. And I knew I had a problem. You know, and so I knew that this thing that you guys gave me, this sobriety, is it can go away. It can go away. That kind of taught me that. They say it a lot of different ways. It depends on what I'm doing. If I'm not doing the right thing, it could go away, and I could end up drunk. You know, and for me to drink, like people say, for me to drink, it's to die. I know that. I watched people go out, and I know the way I was when I got here. So I got sober. Like I say, I got kicked out, and I went down to they have an Alano club down there in Rapid. And I knocked on the door. It was bright and early when the cops kicked me out. So there was nobody in there but the cleaning guy, and he was sweeping. And he heard me knocking on the door, and then he looked up, and he had a little Walkman. He took that off, and he heard me, and then he seen me, and he put his Walkman back on, and he kept on sweeping. And I thought, you know, they told me that if I ever wanted to come to AA, they'd be there. And this guy is just ignoring me, you know. So I left, and I drank as much as I could that day. And started off about 6 in the morning. And drank a lot that day. I went and I was just going to get drunk. I thought, you know, I'm not going to my house. The house I got kicked out of, they were taking it away. The bank was taking it away anyway, so it wasn't a big loss. You know, and I didn't have a job, and didn't have a car, so that's why I was walking. So I just, you know, I didn't know what to do. So I thought, I'll get drunk. I went to a bar and started drinking, and I thought, you know, can't afford to do this all day. So I knew where they'd drink in the morning. So I went over to my buddy's house. And they were doing early morning drinking. That's where you party and, you know, tell jokes. And you just don't drink. I just wanted to drink. And I bugged them, and I said, you know, we need to go get some more. You don't have enough here. And they said, well, you know, just take it easy. And they put on there was a show on. It was an HBO fight. It was a rerun. I didn't know it was a rerun. And it was the first time I'd seen the fight, so I was all excited. But I was drinking, and so I thought, you know, this is we're going to run out of booze. You guys, you don't seem to understand. And then they found a bottle of whiskey, and they gave that to me to shut me up for a while, and they realized that wasn't doing it. They were like, no, you don't understand, guys. I got money. I want to go buy some booze. We got to start drinking here. So they finally did take me to the liquor store, and that was the last day I drank. And went to a different party, and I was getting tired of being around people, and I just loaded up my pockets with booze and took off across the street, across the town, and went up to one of these forts right above my house where the drunks stay. And I started drinking up there. I finished drinking up there. And I hear people say this, and I know what had happened for me, and I think I prayed to God that day. I prayed to God, and I didn't know I was praying to God. I was cussing out God, what I thought I was doing. I thought, you know where I'm at. I know where I'm at. Can't hide nothing from you. I need out of here. I want out. I want out. And I was hoping that, you know, he would die. Send me somewhere else. Not with you people. I was ready to die. I was ready to, and I wanted out. In fact, I had a suicide plan that you know, a lot of us have those suicide plans. And I used to practice. With my, I had a 30-06. I'm a hunter, so I'd practice with my 30-06. And I was real careful because I knew I'd drink a lot, so I'd take the bolt out. Then I got good at it, so I'd put the bolt in, then I would cock it and fire, but I would never have a bullet in it. And I actually saved a special bullet because I knew the way I drank that if I didn't save that bullet, I wouldn't have any. So I hid the bullet above my closet door and went to, I was looking down at the house and looked down there, and I figured, well, they're probably all gone now. That was a house I was kicked out of, and I figured they're probably all gone, and I'll just go down there and get that 30-06 and shoot myself. And, cause I had plenty of good reason, I figured. I was always waiting for the perfect reason, that way people would understand. You know, I wanted them to understand why I did this. I just thought they would think it's strange that I would commit suicide for no reason. So, so I had to wait for that. And, so I headed down there, and then I realized that my gun was in hock. And, and that was a that kind of made me mad, I tell you what. So then I thought, well, I'll just go downtown and I'll just walk in front of a car. Then I thought, you know, just my luck, I'll end up waking up in the hospital again. I already got ran over once. Survived that. So can't do that deal. So I came to AA. I had nowhere else to go. I'd been over there earlier that day, that guy was sweeping the place up. I figured it'd be all cleaned up by now. And I went back there, and they pretty much saved my life. I did get a sponsor. My sponsor was a smart guy. I am attracted to the really smart people. Kind of like myself. That was okay, you know. It was okay. He took me through the steps. He was a real intellectual guy, I guess. And he sponsored a lot of people, and that was good. It was good for me, you know, and sobered up. And what happened was I was sober like 3 or 4 days, and actually I was sober 3 days when I got this sponsor, because it wasn't going too well being sober. It wasn't going well at all. I couldn't stand being sober. I was going crazy. There was stuff coming out in the room. I got a motel room, and I didn't know what to do. So I got the sponsor, and I called him. And I called him at 2 in the morning. And at midnight, I thought, it's too early. It's too late to call him at midnight. So I thought, I'll calm myself down. And at 2 in the morning, that wasn't working. So I realized I better call him. So I called him, and I said, you know, he goes, how's it going? I said, well, hey, how are you doing? He goes, he said, well, why'd you call? Why'd you call? And I said, well, I don't want to drink. He said, well, then why'd you call? I said, well, I called just to let you know I don't want to drink. And then he said, well, it sounds to me like you want to drink. And I said, no, I really, really don't want to drink. But I think I need a drink. I can't do this being sober. Can't do it. So I talked to him. He made me go through the steps. I stayed sober. Whenever I talked to him, I stayed sober. You know, but I do want to thank you guys, because you guys keep me sober. You keep me sober. And I need to be sober. Without this, I could be drunk. Thank you.